Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled today to have as my guest the poet John Hollander. John Hollander is the author of 17 books of poetry, of which the 18th we'll be reading from today, Picture Window, which has recently been published by Knopf. His first, A Crackling of Thorns, was chosen by W.H. Auden as the 1958 volume in the Yale series of younger poets. He has written 8 books of criticism and edited the Laurel Ben Johnson with Harold Bloom, The Wind and the Rain, an anthology of verse for young people, and an anthology of contemporary poetry, Poems of Our Moment. He was a co-editor of the Oxford Anthology of English Literature. He is the co-editor with Anthony Hecht, recently deceased, with whom he shared the Bollingen Prize in Poetry in 1983, of Jiggery Pokery, a compendium of double dactyls. Mr. Hollander attended Columbia and Indiana universities and was a junior fellow of the Society of Fellows of Harvard University. He taught at Connecticut College and Yale and was a professor of English at Hunter College in the Graduate Center, CUNY. He is Sterling Professor Emeritus of English at Yale. In 1990, he received a MacArthur Fellowship. First of all, John, thank you for joining us today.
A great pleasure.
And I've asked you today to read from your current collection, Picture Window, but I've also asked you to pick a couple other poems as well, if you would like. So I'm going to turn the show over to you and just ask you to read the poems which you're most fond of from your current collection. I know that's kind of like asking about favorite children, but...
Well, it's ask about favorite children depends on which day, which child is your favorite very often. And I find this is often the true with poems of mine. But let me... I suppose I should read the title poem from Picture Window and say a word about it. I use one, I'm afraid I use one German word in it, an art historian's word, Rückfiguren, which means figures in paintings, particularly German romantic paintings like those of Caspar David Friedrich. When you see a landscape, and in the landscape are figures, but they're all facing the landscape as you are, so you see the backs of their heads.
Okay.
And they are like versions of you projected into the picture, etc. And because of this, you'll see in a minute what the story is that has to happen. Now, the term picture window came in my later childhood when, for the first time, plate glass windows, which are the norm now, so you wouldn't have to say picture window.
Mm-hmm.
You did that. The handsome fellow visiting us in the mountains stood at the picture window, giving on, as they used to say, a view of 3 bright sister peaks we call Patty, Peggy, and Polly. Seen from behind, he composed one of those images they call, the Germans, Rückfiguren. His back, backed by the facing prospect, facing us, while the ever-changing end of the daylight wrought continual wonders on the hills, shedding cloaks of shadow over parts of the valley visible from where he stood, gazing at what I realized as he touched his chin briefly, the better to inspect something about it, was merely his own image he was admiring. That was all he could see in the window. Not the world, as it yielded up alms in one of its all too infrequent moments of beauty, simple and non-contingent. Too bad that in a glass, lightly, face to mirrored face, he could only toy in the worst way with that splendid modern instrument of truth, plate glass, which superimposes mirrored patches of the gazer's face and bits of the space out of which he looks upon all that he might be seeing. Something of subject seen as inescapable from all sight of the object of its regard. Better that we see through ourselves, through our very seeing itself, the better to live with, save in opacities of talk of them, the indivisibility of our transparency of body and the mind's complicating, fragile reflectiveness.
Beautiful. let's hear more.
All right. Well, these are four very short poems, quite different. Each one is a little poem of the kind we'd really call an epigram. Not that it's a funny gag-like verse, but a short bit. I've grouped these four because they're all related under the title of Four Timepieces. Each one's about a different kind of clock or watch. And the first one is called Epitaph for the Sundial's Gnomon. The gnomon, of course, being the metal piece that sticks up that casts a shadow on the dial. And this is, and the gnomon is speaking its own epitaph.
Okay.
I cast the shortest light at highest noon along the dial when life was longest. Soon the line extended in the tedium of post-meridian attenuations, absorbing darkness, pointing out in some how lengthenings are somber adumbrations. As I stood there, cold, silent, unafraid, my shadow vanished in the deepening shade. And the second one is quite literally sent to the poet, younger poet, Carl Kirschway, who had sent me a gift of a stopwatch.
Oh.
Poets who read and who read responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
A great many do, but some do not, who read responsibly time things.
Okay.
And a stopwatch is a great gift when you're going to give a reading. So I wrote him, in place of an appropriate quid pro splendid quo, I send herewith this little rhyme, reminded that the overly extended or langweilig was never the sublime, that the time comes when anything is ended, that everything we do is done in time. And the third one is another sundial, which gets one basic image in it from the 17th century poet George Herbert from a Latin poem. So it's about the sundial. Heaven and earth are joined together here by this machine of sound bronze above fragile grass. It owes its light to heaven and to the ground its shadow. So with the heart of what we are, fed from above us and below, from far within and deep beyond us, which we understand as a sun shadow problem of our own ghost and machine-like kind. How frightened the ground would be without the light. The body without the mind.
Beautiful.
And finally, one called The Figure in the face being the clock face. And as I read this, you have to imagine a clock face with the hands at the position of the time indicated.
Okay.
So the first poem starts with the time 6:27. Imagine.
Okay.
The clock is talking. 6:27 and I'm at my best. By 10 past 10, I'm plunged into despair up to my waist. It quite hides all the rest of me, my helpless arms raised in the air. 2:45 or 9:15, one arm is lowered, as if short of breath itself. 4:20, I become the sign of clocks stopped at the hour of Lincoln's death. One-armed at midnight, and again at noon, I see no difference. I keep pointing high toward no hawk, no star, no escaped balloon, but the clock's confining arc of sky. With wisdom that no gesture can impeach, I know my grasp of things exceeds my reach. And maybe I'll read just one more short poem.
Oh, absolutely.
Although not from this book. This is a poem called An Old-Fashioned Song. French school children like to sing and dance. To our, their equivalent of our Ring Around a Rosie, actually. Okay. And the song they sing, the words are, Nous n'irons plus au bois, les lauriers sont coupés. We won't go to the woods anymore, the laurel trees have all been cut down. So, this is called an old-fashioned soup. No more walks in the wood. The trees have all been cut down. And where once they stood, not even a wagon rut appears along the path. Low brush is taking over. No more walks in the wood. This is the aftermath of afternoons in the clover fields, where we once made love, then wandered home together, where the trees arched above. Where we made our own weather when branches were the sky. Now they're gone for good, and you for ill, and I am only a passerby. We and the trees and the way back from the fields of play lasted as long as we could. No more walks in the wood.
That's beautiful. John, this new collection it's very rich, very human, and very moving. What is it about this collection that you're happiest?
Oh, with it? Well, I think it best represents, of course, it by nature it represents what I was doing at a certain time, but I think it represents my state of mind at the time. Well, there are different sections and different kinds of poems in them, and some are a little bit closer to being topical, and some are much more meditative in I suppose not in a spiritual way at all, but in much more in a philosophical way, I suppose. And I think it has a nice spread that covers the different kinds of things that were in my mind during that period. When you've written quite a few books in the course of your life, averaging out to one every 4 or 5 years or so, I guess, more than that, they'll be quite different because of what you were doing and thinking about during that period. And sometimes a book of poems, in several instances, in my case, one book has been one long poem, although many parts. In this case, no. And I'm still fond of it. But I'm already deeply engrossed in putting together a new book and tending to think of that more. So I haven't thought about Picture Window for a while. The title poem is the title poem, well, a number of reasons. There would be certain, since I didn't have a general title, and I've been tending to title books of poems after poems in them. the professors would say the title poem was a metonymy of a whole book, and you choose one to be, you want to represent the book. And I thought this poem that I read, Picture Window, did. There are some other poems that think about allied subjects, and I think this refers to and implies them once you see them in context in the book. And so I like it, but as I say, I'm on to other things now and thinking about them.
Sure. Now, we're at the Sewanee Writers Conference, which is just a beautiful place in the mountains of Tennessee. And you've been on the faculty here how many times now?
I haven't dared count. It's either 6 or 7.
6 or 7?
Probably 6, but I'm
probably
not sure.
Probably 6. And what is it that you like most about coming down here and being with younger poets and aspiring poets in the faculty of fine poets that you have here?
It's immensely serious, and that's what makes it fun. I find that, particularly over the years, the first year I came, the people whose work I looked at, etc., it was was much more of a chore to do it because they were much less sophisticated. They knew less. Really, they had less of a culture of poetry. Mm-hmm. And excuse me, of literature in general. Mm-hmm. And each year, the work looks better and better and better. And this year, one can enjoy teaching a workshop, particularly with another poet one likes and admires. And I've been very fortunate in that every time I've been here, because the people that I have taught the workshop with have been people I liked and respected, mm-hmm. and been able to learn from. Mm-hmm. We usually think we sort of earn our money at the conferences by going over somebody's portfolio of work in detail and spending an hour with them over it. And this time it's been thoroughly enjoyable doing that.
Good, that's very encouraging.
And this is a mark of how I think things have progressed. But in general, the place is serious. One of the things I like most about it is the other writers. Mm-hmm. And they've all been splendid. I've learned from all of them.
That's good.
Enjoyed spending time with them over the years. And I think it's exemplary. I haven't heard of any summer writers center, which is, I think, comes within miles of this.
I would agree. Good. Well, could we hear a few more poems from Picture Windows?
Okay. Let me think what would be.
How about let's hear two more.
What?
Let's hear.
I'll hear one more from Picture Window, and then maybe one short one not from it, if
good.
That's all right.
Sure.
It was a poem that I used to, for years, like to end readings with.
Okay, good.
And this short reading.
Good.
But this is a poem which is very serious, but also, I hope, funny. It's called In Transit, and it has an epigraph from Emerson, and I copied it out because I liked it, and then sort of took off from it. It's Emerson's very, very poetic language in writing prose. He says, all symbols are fluxional. All language is vehicular and transitive. Both of those words used in a special sense, metaphorical sense about language, transitive. He doesn't mean just grammatically transitive verb. Mm-hmm. I hit him as opposed to I suffer, which is not
sure.
Transitive. But carrying forward, language is action. All language is vehicular and transitive, and is good as ferries and horses are for conveyance, not as farms and houses are for homestead. Also, I couldn't read this without remembering the use of the term vehicle by the great literary and rhetorical theorist I.A. Richards, who was a teacher of my whole generation, and even a teacher of the teachers of my generation, a wonderful man who was at Cambridge for a long time and then was at Harvard for a wonderful man, and he used the term for a metaphor, the terms tenor and vehicle, meaning the literal sense and the figurative sense.
Okay.
The literal sense sort of was the vehicle that carried in it the tenor. So, and just ending with the Emerson, not as horses are for conveyance, but not as horses are for conveyance, not as farms and houses are for homestead. Well then, if that's the case, let's start packing and get going. Not packing it all in, of course, but all up. And with some brawny friends and brainy lovers, let's get all our stuff loaded on some truck and get it on its way, whatever way that may indeed be toward whatever place. Metaphoron in modern Greek conveys the sense of moving van, if you speak modern Greek. A vehicle crammed with a mishmash of tenors that should not be allowed to rot at home. Too much of the untransferred literal all too soon rots in the due course. On with it then, and off we go. The city side, the chartered views high from the cabled bridges, the long haul through the echoing tunnel, the wide traverse of non-urban sprawl, and then the countryside, its various cells, all rushing by to fill spaces we vacate, one by fleeting one. Are we talking about the springtime here? Early forsythia moving the very air forward into another place-like state of things? The scheduled time for moving? But even the dullest February dawn gives up its first catatonic sulk and soon starts loading up with the innermost of motions, assuring that each new morning will be moving day. Semper eadem, constant. True enough for some things, such as Latin mottos like itself, but with all the stuff of our lives, we have to keep going, going, or we will all be gone. Rumble of diesel, crush of huge tires over protesting gravel, shouts, whining, and boom of boombox indeterminately modulate through the long roar of the road as all is transported over the widest but most unseen of interstates to where we hear only summer's drone at the end of the rhododendrons, if only the soundless groan of the dark, shiny green in which its leaves are so dustily absorbed, as if remembering their time of blossoming back in that other place from which they had been moved in the vast 18-wheeler that, getting on with things, has brought them and us to the place that was right here all along.
Beautiful. Thank you. Well, let's, if you have a particular poem that you'd like to end with.
It's a poem about Adam naming the animals that I wrote a very long time ago, and I had stopped reading so quite a time ago at the end of readings, but I sort of would like to come back, and I've been thinking more about the relation of people and animals in the last 10, 15 years than I ever had before. Genesis tells us that Adam named all the beasts of the field and the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the air, etc. He got to name them. There are two commentaries on that text in Genesis that I've always liked. One of them was a medieval rabbinic commentary that said, no, as a matter of fact, the angels were supposed to name the animals first, and God had the angels there and then paraded in front of them a cow, a horse, a dog, and said, what are their names? And the angel said, we don't know, we've never seen these before, how do we know what their names are? But Adam, who was standing by, said, horse, cow, dog, and God was so delighted he let Adam name the animals. That's one commentary. The other is a commentary of a learned scholar, Philo of Alexandria, who said that he'd been thinking, I suppose, of a particular dialogue of Plato that's about names and things and meanings of words. And he said that when the cow first had its name called out to it, named by Adam, cow, it responded as if it had had that name all its life. In other words, Adam's first applied name was a natural name.
Sure.
So here is Adam. Since I've always thought of Adam naming the animals as the first poem, and all the animals are named. You can't give it a new name if you discover a new animal. The most that will happen is your name will be knitted into its Latin name, but its Latin name has to be that because of the way we name. So,
sure.
Right. So, here is Adam naming the animals. Thou, paw, paw, paw. Thou, glurred. Thou, spotted glurred. Thou, white stap lurching through the high-grown brush. Thou, pliant-footed implex. Thou, a wagaboo. Every burrower, each flyer, came for the name he had to give. Gay, first work ever to be prior. not yet sunk to primitive. Thou, Wirtle, thou, McCleary's Puma, thou, three types of Grawl, thou, Flisket, thou, Kabash, thou, comma-eared Mashhawk, thou all, were in a fire of becoming, laboring to be burned away, then work, half measuring, half humming, would be as serious as play. Thou, Pambler, thou, Ravarn, thou, greater Warrant, and thou, lesser one, thou, Sproul, thou, Zant, thou, Lily Eater. Naming's over, day's done.
Thank you very much. Our guest today has been John Hollander, and he's been reading from Picture Window and some of his other poems, which has been published by Knopf. And John, thank you so much for your generous gift of your time today.
My pleasure.